Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Philip Schofield says he's lost everything in the wake of his affair with a younger male colleague. In an interview with the BBC, he says the fallout's been relentless and it's had a catastrophic effect on his mind. Another strike by railway workers is causing more misery for train passengers today. RMT members have walked out. The National Deaf Children's Society are launching their Every Moment Counts campaign. Susan Daniels is the charity's chief executive.
Having access to that advice and information and guidance and making those decisions about how to communicate, what kind of hearing technology to use, is so important.
And the refereeing body, PGMOL, says it's appalled by unjustified and abhorrent abuse directed at Anthony Taylor after video footage emerged of him being accosted by angry fans at Budapest Airport. From Radio News Hub, I'm Edward Breslin.
At Tesco Mobile, we want to help you get the most out of summer. So when you bag our 100 gig SIM for just £16 a month with club card prices, there are no EU roaming fees this summer. Perfect for scrolling, uploading, searching and strolling. This is Supermarket Mobile. Search Tesco Mobile. Every little helps.
Ends 16th of July, was £17.50. Club card 24-month contract and unlocked 4G phone required. Full terms, list of roaming destinations and charges are at tescomobile.com/terms.
Coming up, 5 in the Eye with Michael and Phil.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, colorful.com and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Wait, that's RJ on the track.
Yo, look, why you gotta feed me lies? I ain't hungry for none of that BS. Big stepper like I'm PS. She give me in the back of the Prius. On you from my head of DS. Ask if I like you back, why ES? Old school days hiding when they see us. They better bomb on it. Look, I feel like I'm making my bag. Why? Steady trying to get paid. I be in a lab, no breaking bad. Now we did a bad one, like Vanessa from Blade. Or maybe one from the States. Darling, I don't mean to be selfish, but selfish is just one of my traits. I don't give a toss if I'm late. Look, she said she wanna be big. Darling, it don't work that way. If I had a pound for every time somebody told me I can't, I'd be clearer than Dave. Old school days, hunting for a Santan. Instance getting trapped in a date. Belly on face, stepping out as a black man. Cause the feds want me in a cage. Look, why you gotta feed me lies? I ain't hungry for none of that BS. Big stepper like I'm PS. She give me in the back of the Prius. On you from my head of DS. Ask if I like you back, why ES? Old school days, hiding when they see us. They better run when they... Look, old school days running around making a sound. Jumpy settings on the christening. Jay Way on the lip tick. Tumpy settings on your listening. And this one's too enticing. Shouldn't even need to break her back. Rum time home of the gully and Gaza. Young boy dishing up. Told my young boy stay off the road and keep your head down like it's heads down, thumbs up. My Jamaican ting with the biggest of bats. Come try offer me some rum punch. Had to show her I'm not on the drinking ting, baby. I'd rather just smoke. But you can rub me down while I talk. And then I can to you. Listening to reggae and calypso with my yard one, but she's not like reggae. Hosted up with my T and Zegge, trying to kick back and see what's on telling. When the back come, read to a lorry, baby, slow down while you jigger like jelly. Caribbean one come brown, as round, figure eight like Keisha from Billy. Look, why you gotta feed me lies? I ain't hungry for none of that BS. Big stepper like I'm PS, she give me in the back of the Prius. On you from my head of DS, ask if I like you back, white ES. Old school days, hiding when they see us, they better run when they... Look, why you gotta feed me lies? I ain't hungry for none of that BS. Big stepper like I'm PS. She give me in the back of the Prius. On you from my head of DS. Ask if I like you back, why ES? Old school days hiding when they see us. They better run when it.
Yeah. price, oh. I pray to God make me no crash, oh. Cause our love no get spare parts, oh. As I'm a man, I can give you the best part, oh. I know if you see beauty, the next track, oh. Hey, but let you push, I know more you this smart, oh. And if you ever don't have first class, oh. She now you waiting, they hold me down when they rap by, you know, they. Man, take it, they play. I can't let you go, baby, no way. Baby, my katakwa, and if no believe, man, I'm on kwetakwa. They laughing at me, my haman kwetakwa. Say, I go ride for you, go hard for you. My kimana man is so cool. Mwani man, you me go, my baby, oh. Ride for you, go hard for you. My kimana man is so cool. Yeni man, you me go, so give my baby, oh. No, bodo, na.
Carry talk for this track. Oh.
One man up and they so. Baby, give me love and try to. She sabi cook, she sabi do. I never met nobody like you. Oh, oh, oh. She na you every day, hold me down when you ramani no day. Man, give me take away. I know go let you go, baby, go away. Oh, my jam is deep for the matter. Get your bami, take down a wonder. Okay, get your weight, can you act?
Miss ya, baby. Me miss ya, miss ya, miss ya. Hello, baby, can you come over? Right now, loneliness taking over. Me need you tonight, yeah, me lover. Come warm me up under the cover. Make me rock till the lamp shade turn over. Rub me chest, rest your head by my shoulder. I make me listen some Anita Baker. Make love till we wake up the neighbor. Girl, you're all I need, and I'm always missing you. Miss you, baby. Miss you. I need your tenderness. I can't resist you. Miss you, baby. Miss you. Girl, hug me up, squeeze me tight and close. Come here, make me brace you for me king size pose. Me and you forever, girl. Now go divorce. We toast to long life. We are prosper the most. Love your tone of voice when you call me name. Over and over, she scream again. In me arms, me want you to remain till the sunshine come out again. Girl, you're all I need. And I'm
5 in the Eye with Michael and Phil.
5 in the Eye with Michael and Phil. It's news, but is it new?
Welcome. It's Friday on Colourful Radio, and that means it's 5 in the Eye Day. But perhaps 5 in the Eye as you never heard it before, because for 1 week only, we're abandoning our familiar five-story structure and focusing on just three topics. Big stories from Africa that are perhaps not getting the attention in the UK media they deserve. I'm Phil Woodford in London, very much looking forward to episode 0413.
And this is me, Michael O'Hajuru, joining Phil via Zoom this week and revealing that we thought this was a very special show. We acquired a very special guest. He's an expert on Africa and economic development at the University of London. It's Dr. Mark Simpson. Hello there, Mark, and thanks so much for joining us here on 5 in the Eye.
5 in the Eye.
Thanks, Michael. Hello, Phil. It's a pleasure to be here on Colourful Radio. We're going to be looking at three big stories today, and I'll do my best to shed some light on them. It was logical that we should move south across the continent, starting with Sudan, where a conflict is currently raging, and then stopping off at Uganda, which is under international scrutiny at the moment for its draconian new law on homosexuality. Finally, it's just the short step across to Rwanda. The country, British Home Secretary Suella Braverman recently claimed as one of the safest in the world to send desperate refugees to.
So let's embark on our very special journey and kick off this week's Five in the Eye.
Five in the Eye.
Well, we're going to start this week by talking about the crisis in Sudan. And I think to a lot of listeners, Mark, this seemed to come out of the blue. We don't get a lot of coverage of the country in the British media. And the way it's been presented to us is there are two factions of the military. There's the kind of the main armed forces who seem to be pitched against what's known as the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. And there are two strong men in charge of each of these factions. Now, my understanding is that these guys were pals not too long ago, and they were responsible collectively, were they not, for ousting the former leader, the former president al-Bashir, back in 2019. And yet they seem to have fallen out and are now engaged in a struggle for power. Perhaps you could just give us a little bit more background on kind of what's led up to this.
Right.
Because the situation that we see in terms of humanitarian suffering seems truly awful, and it's really exploded in a very short space of time.
Right. Thanks, Phil. I think this is a even more topical than normally would be the case, because just a few hours ago, the army representatives withdrew from the mediation talks, which are being held in Saudi Arabia under the auspices of the Saudis and the Americans. I think it's important just very briefly to point out that the role of the military in Sudanese politics has been very prominent ever since independence. Since 1956, there have been 6 or 7 successful military coups and countless others. The armed forces have come to constitute a state within a state, if you like. They have their own business interests. Their budget is never in the public domain. You have often coups within coups, which arguably is what is happening at the moment. In terms of background, what happened was that there was a democratic transition after the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir by the military. Omar al-Bashir was himself a military officer who came to power through a military coup. And you had popular demonstrations calling for Bashir's removal, and the military stepped in to take control of that process. A transitional arrangement was put in place, led by the military, which was strongly contested by the civilian groupings who did not want a military-led transition to civilian rule. And eventually, this transitional arrangement, which brought together civilian figures and military figures, was overturned by yet another military coup in October 2021. The civilians were arrested. The civilian prime minister went into hiding. And then they dissolved the Transitional Sovereign Council. And this has been followed by rising tensions between the army and the rapid support forces led by a gentleman called Hemeti, as the army tries to bring in these rapid support forces into its fold. They worked together closely for a while, but each has their own distinct interests, their own revenue streams, and the RSF decided that it did not want to be part of this new arrangement, and then you got the eruption of violence between the army and the RSF in April.
And Mark, there's a relationship back, isn't there, to the conflict in Darfur? Because the former president al-Bashir was implicated in serious crimes there, but also this RSF is linked to the Janjaweed, which we heard talked about at the time. Can you just explain that relationship a little bit?
Yes. It's worth pointing out that Omar al-Bashir is still to this day the only sitting head of state indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. He nurtured the Janjaweed militia to fight against a rebellion in Darfur. They subsequently transmogrified into the RSF and became, if you like, Omar al-Bashir's Praetorian Guard. Al-Bashir himself was careful to move his chess pieces around within the security forces so that none of them were dominant, but also allowed them to be self-sufficient in terms of revenue streams. They were allowed to build up their own business empires. And that's one of the issues at stake here in the dispute between the RSF and al-Bashir as general, the general in charge of the Sudanese army at the moment.
The business interests. I mean, we were talking before the show, and you were telling me about the links that exist with the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And I think a lot of people in the UK would be quite shocked to think that there was a connection. And the connection appears to be through this murky organization, this mercenary group called Wagner, which is operating in areas like Bakhmut in Ukraine, but also has a presence in Africa. Can you unpick that one for us? Because it seems crazy, doesn't it, that these conflicts are somehow interlinked?
Yes. I think the role of Wagner has to be seen against the backdrop of a longstanding Russian interest in securing a naval port on the Red Sea. In fact, before his fall, al-Bashir had negotiated a preliminary arrangement with the Russians to allow them access to Port Sudan. What this would have meant was that they could project their power in the Red Sea and in turn link up with their naval base in Syria, in a place called Tartus, through the canal. And it's important again to remember that one of the reasons why the Kremlin came out and supported Assad was because they wanted to maintain that presence on the Syrian coast. And this would have provided the Russian Navy with the power to interdict a vital Western artery by controlling, if you like, both ends of the Suez Canal. In terms of Wagner, Wagner has been granted mining rights in Sudan, gold mining rights. There are figures of up to $1.6 billion worth of gold smuggled out of Sudan, unaccounted for in the Sudanese treasury accounts. Wagner is known to have a gold processing facility north of Khartoum. It takes the gold from artisanal miners. They get shipped to the UAE, and that revenue is probably what is financing its own operations in the Ukraine.
Absolutely. Extraordinary connections that you're painting for us here, Mark. And I mean, it shows a really, really complex web. I mean, if coming back to the two main factions that are fighting at the moment, if one of them were to prevail in the conflict, whether help from outside or through their own initiative, what would it actually mean for the people of Sudan? I mean, do either of these leaders have any particular ideology or vision that would take Sudan in one direction or another? Or is it just a battle between two kind of power-hungry warlords with their own military capabilities?
I think where they share common interests, Phil, is in avoiding at all costs accountability to a civilian government for past malfeasance, including in places like Sudan, and in terms of what they are doing now to the Sudanese people, which is holding millions in Khartoum and Omdurman hostage without water, electricity, medical facilities, while they battle it out to see who's going to come out as top dog. This is going to be one of the challenges going forward. There, as far as I see it, there are two main issues that are going to come out of any sort of ceasefire. Firstly, how do you return to the aborted transition to civilian rule? What's the detailed roadmap for that? And are there going to be, as opposed to the past, international guarantees and guarantors that are going to ensure compliance with the detailed roadmap?
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, this may be where we're going to have to leave it, because we do need to move on. But it, just a final question to you, Mark. You know, who is the power that could broker some kind of deal and make it stick? I mean, we've seen that the Gulf powers have an interest, and they're trying to make some kind of compromise, but that seems to be on the rocks.
Right.
Clearly, the traditional Western powers have interests. Russia has interests, but China as well. Are they a player in this?
They're a minor player. I think one of the things that's happening within diplomatic circles is the realization how little leverage external players have over what is happening. Egypt, possibly, which has always been the kind of big brother next door to Sudan, close relations with the Sudanese Defense Force, could play a restraining role there. But just to pick up again, very briefly on this detailed roadmap, the fly in the ointment is going to be getting both sides to agree to take part in a robust security sector reform process, which is, it will involve their disarmament, demobilization, reintegration, their willingness to be subject to civilian control by a civilian executive, parliamentary scrutiny of their budgets, their sources of revenue, etc.
It sounds as if we're a rather long way away from that, right, yeah, at the moment, Mark. I have to say, yeah, everything you've told us. Well, absolutely fascinating to pick your brains on that topic. But we're going to move on to another important and topical issue in Africa. Michael's going to lead off on this. We're going to go to Uganda.
Five in the Eye.
It's a story that's almost come from nowhere, but you can put it in perspective, Mark, hopefully. It's what's happening in Uganda. It's just passed the most draconian in the world laws on homosexuality. You can be jailed for life for being homosexual, and under some circumstances, the death penalty. Now, this is extraordinary.
Right.
But then when you look around Africa, It's not uncommon for them to be, right, African countries to be against homosexuality. What I'd like to understand, Mark, is why now? What's changed? What's changed in the government? Is this a performative thing, or is the political power behind this? Do the people want this?
Right. Very, very good question, Michael. It had me stumped. It also came out of the blue. I thought this was an issue that had been put to rest, because way back in 2014, a not dissimilar bill was passed by Parliament, enacted, and then challenged and overturned in the Constitutional Court. So this is nearly 8 years ago. Now this has been revised in an even more radical, obscene form. And as you rightly point out, there are provisions for extended sentences, I think 20 years for something subject to interpretation by prosecutors, namely promoting, quote unquote, homosexuality. And that is particularly pernicious, because it might be interpreted as including any advocacy on the rights of Uganda's LGBTQ community. There's also provision for, I think it's 7-year jail terms for those found to knowingly allow their premises to be used for homosexual activities. Where this has come from is really baffling to me. Every single ruling party MP, save one very brave gentleman who has stood out against it, voted in favor of the bill. I'm not sure that Museveni needed to, at this moment in time, stiffen the sinews of the ranks and ensure unity around the issue. What it has triggered, possibly to his advantage, is a strong domestic amongst the political elite domestic anti-Western rhetoric.
It's certainly messed up the West. You know, Britain came up with some weasel words. What was it? They were appalled. This is an attack on democracy and human rights. And it says all the right things. And then America says equally, or Joe Biden says equally the same thing, said it's shameful. But then at the same time, you have to think, well, these people don't donate money to Uganda. The aid suppliers, literally aid. They do work for AIDS. So it's in the country's good to try and help them. But then the Ugandans are saying, we're not interested. If you want to take the money away, do so. My frustration with this Mark, is this old, you know, the China-Russia thing. You don't get any lectures on morals and governance from them. They just get on with it. They leave you. What was it, the glib thing? In America, you get a lecture. From China, you get an airport.
Right. So, true.
I have a frustration here. Are they really saying, enough of the West? We are our own people now. We don't need your money.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, it has triggered, and this may be to Museveni's advantage, strong anti-Western, anti-neocolonial rhetoric amongst his rank and file. At the same time, domestic human rights advocates are pointing out the obvious, which is that this law violates Uganda's own constitution. A number of other key international instruments, such as the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and most importantly, which is ironic because Museveni is a strong Pan-Africanist, the continent's own African Charter on Human and People's Rights, which includes commitments to dignity and non-discrimination. So this will be challenged, and I think with a good chance of being successful in Uganda's own constitutional court.
Sorry, Mark.
Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
I was going to say, when I was fascinated by reading and looking at this, that the speaker of the Ugandan government, the Ugandan government, is fully regaled like an English speaker in the House of Parliament with the wig on and get that some sense of this is almost like a British court. And it says of all the things that come from that, the constitution, constitutional thoughts that come from that. Well, maybe the courts are the key here, because the courts did throw this out before.
Right.
So maybe to your point, because it's not constitutional, that it ain't going to work.
Yeah. I mean, one needs to bet on the quality of the Ugandan bench and their independence from the executive power. That's where it's going to lie. And it was on that's what allowed the 2014 Act to be thrown out.
Mm.
And so one can only hope that the legal team of the human rights activists and the LGBT community activists are good, and that the judiciary is independent of the executive and does not suffer undue pressure.
Can I ask you just a closing question about coming back to this subtext? What part do you think the American fundamentalists are playing in this? Because they're all over Africa, you know, and they're putting a lot of money into this, or they've got a lot of money.
Right.
Spreading the word of the Lord and redemption and Christianity and moral majority and all the things that's driven them to be a power force in America. They're applying to Africa and to African Christians. And then when you link in the Israel thing, it all gets a bit heated. They're in a powerful force here? They're a relevant force?
Yeah. No, undoubtedly. I have no doubt that far-right fundamentalist Christian groups from the U.S. are there in Uganda preaching a particular view which leads Museveni, amidst many other problems, to decide that the priority is to persecute those of a particular sexual orientation at this moment in time. One thing I did pick up over the last 48 hours, which was interesting, was that one of the MPs who voted in favor of the bill offered to travel to the Middle East, which, as we know, has very strong anti-homosexual legislation in place, in order to find funding to replace that from Western donors should the aid tap be turned off.
Wow, alternatives.
So we have a very unholy alliance likely building up.
Now, we live in very strange times in geopolitical terms, yes, in terms of who's doing what,
yes, where,
with who and why. And I'm sure we're going to come back to this. I want to move on to our final story this week, and it's about Rwanda.
Five in the Eye.
I'd like to get your view on the fact that, let's put aside Suella, Suella Braverman's policy for a moment. Let's just talk about Rwanda as a country. Now, Rwanda seems to be a country of great possibilities. That's on the surface. I've seen the way it promotes itself internationally.
Right.
It's a young country, vibrant, tourism, beautiful country, an open country, safe.
Right.
You know, am I looking at rose-tinted glasses? Is the reality somewhat different on the ground? Are there issues? It's not as beautiful as they were painted to be.
Kagame is extremely adept at promoting Uganda, not only through sponsoring Arsenal, for example, inviting people to come and see the guerrillas, etc. And it is beautiful. Just don't visit the prisons. Just don't go next door to the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo and look at the horrific population displacements that have taken place as a result of Rwanda's military intervention on a continual basis.
So are you saying the genocide is still continuing? The Hutu thing is still continuing?
What has happened is that Rwanda, for decades now, has intervened in the DRC for two primary reasons. One, it's concerned about a revival of Hutu power, because that's where the Hutus fled to. And it has used indigenous Tutsis to fight against the central government in Kinshasa. Secondly, it has pillaged and plundered the natural resources of its neighboring country. And there is copious documentation on this produced by successive UN panels of experts tracking natural and mineral resources from the DRC to the coffers of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which then get exported and generate critical revenue, both for the ruling party, but also for the Rwandan military, who have their own corporations involved in the mining of cadmium, lithium, timber, vital, critical resources, given the technology that we use nowadays, like iPhones, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, critical. But hang on a second, I've got to stop you there. Rwanda's population, was it 10, 12, 13 million? DRC is 100 million.
Yeah.
There's an imbalance there. You know, you're saying the Rwandans are holding the DRC.
What you have to understand is that Rwanda has become an African Sparta. It is a highly militarized state. The Rwandan Patriotic Front equals the Rwandan Patriotic Army. Its current head of state, Kagame, was a military commander for many years. Everybody does military service. And in a way, like the Wagner Group, it offers its services outside its country. So, for example, if you cast your mind back to that Islamic uprising in northern Mozambique, you may remember during the pandemic, there was an Al-Shabaab uprising in northern Mozambique. The Rwandans intervened, very easily crushed this nascent Islamic insurgency in the north of Mozambique. And then guess what? one finds out that the primary investor there is Total, the French company, which was about to exploit gas. This is then followed by a visit by Kagame to Paris, where he embraces Macron, they make their pieces, and 500 million euros of development assistance is then given to Rwanda.
So is Rwanda playing the game here? Because at the same time, it's part of the Commonwealth, wants to join in that kind of open institution, and yet it's taking money from the French, and it's, I don't know, this is a bit of a revelation. I wasn't aware of that connection to the DRC. So
right.
does that mean if the military is as strong as you say it is, then Rwanda must be a safe country then? You know, in terms of for tourists to move around freely. You know, no El Shabazz or Boko Haram here. It's very calm, peaceful.
Absolutely. It's as Braverman said, it's one of the safest countries in the world, depending who you are. And the problem is that there was a terrible experience for refugees in Rwanda in 2018, 11 or 12 refugees who were protesting against their living conditions were shot dead by the police. This is copiously documented by Human Rights Watch and other respectable international NGOs. For protesting against their living conditions, they were first tear gassed and then live ammunition was used. And then subsequently, they were charged, some of those who survived were charged with bringing down the international image of Rwanda. And this is the country that Braverman insists illegal migrants should be sent to.
Let me get this right. So if you fit in, if you accept the way that the status quo as it is, and it seems to be quite peaceful, but there's a price you pay for that peace. There's a military strong arm ready to kind of put you in your place the moment you step out of place.
Most definitely. One of the ironic things was that just before Braverman made her statement in Kigali during her visit in March, the U.S. State Department issued its report on human rights practices in Rwanda for the year 2022. And it listed a whole series of problems, of issues, unlawful, arbitrary killings, the use of torture, life-threatening prison conditions, arbitrary detention, restrictions on free expression and the media, restrictions on political participation, harassment of human rights organizations. And this is happening while Braverman is standing there on the lawn in Kigali saying, this is the safest place in the world.
That's extraordinary. You got that background to that setting. And we're going to finish here, Mark, but look, you've raised some real issues here. We haven't resolved anything interesting. We haven't resolved it. You just put these things, up here in terms of what's happening in Sudan, the issues in Uganda, how's that going to resolve? Could the court sort this out? And here in Rwanda, is it as safe for refugees as we say? So look, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to close here by saying, look, you've got to come back on the show and kind of, I don't say clean these things up, sort them out, but at least
or maybe even take us on a tour of some other African nations, because it's been so educational to them.
Right, absolutely.
Five in the Eye.
Well, it's certainly been an enlightening and highly unusual edition of Five in the Eye. We didn't manage any quirky stories this week, but hope you found our discussion on Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda as illuminating as we did. And thanks so much to Mark for joining us and sharing his extensive knowledge on episode 0413. If you want to get in touch with us over the weekend, please do visit our Facebook page. And for now, this is me, Michael O'Hijori, saying, as always, if you have been, thanks for listening.
And this is Mark Simpson, thanking both Phil and Michael for the invitation, saying goodbye and wishing you well for the week ahead.
And until next time, I'm Phil Woodford, reminding you to keep an eye on the news, as you never know what we'll be discussing on episode
5 in the Eye with Michael and Phil.
Feeling all over. I can blow him out.